Welcome to Warships Pod, and our guest for this episode is Steve Prest, a former Commodore in the Royal Navy who had a varied career that included a tour in Afghanistan, an exchange with the French Navy, and being Weapon Engineer Officer in HMS Westminster during that warship's operations off Libya and in the Arabian Sea. Steve was also a Commander Weapon Engineer in the carrier HMS Queen Elizabeth, bringing that ship out of build. His other jobs in the Navy included being Program Director of the Type 31 Frigate Program and the RN's First Fleet Robotics Officer. Leaving the Navy in 2023, Steve, who is an Associate Fellow of the Royal United Services Institute, now has a portfolio career in the defence sector and beyond. This includes working as an independent consultant, advisor and lecturer, all of it aiming to fulfil his stated mission of helping brilliant people do amazing things. Welcome, Steve.
Ian, it's great to see you. Thanks for having me on.
No, it's great to have you here. And there's a wide variety of things I think we can discuss. But I'd like to start, first of all, with just getting a bit of background on yourself. So why did you pick the Royal Navy as a career after reading electronic and electrical engineering at Loughborough?
Well, my inspiration for the Navy really goes all the way back to childhood. That was where the seed was planted. My father comes from Cleveland, so North Yorkshire, up on the coast. And as you will know, and I'm sure your listeners will know, that's Captain Cook country. And Captain Cook is my naval hero for a number of reasons. But I was always really conscious of his influence up there. We used to walk up to his monument with my paternal grandparents and so on. Anyway, we were doing explorers as a topic in primary school. And I remember the teacher saying that Cook was a very strange boy because normally in that time, it was normal to follow your father into whatever their line of work was. But Cook didn't want to follow his father into laboring and whatever else his dad did. Actually, he wanted to join the Navy and sail around the world. And I remember thinking as a, whatever, 7, 8, 9-year-old, well, I don't think that's strange at all. I think if I'd been him, I'd have wanted to do exactly the same thing. And so that really planted the seed. And I've had a lifelong passion for ships and the sea. And when I left school, I picked up a sponsorship with the Civil Service, the Defence Engineering and Science Group. And as part of that, I spent a year between my A-levels and university at Loughborough at the Royal Navy Engineering College at Manadon in Plymouth. And that was the last year, sadly, the college was open. But I had a wonderful time. I immersed myself in the college life. I played rugby for the college and indeed the combined naval colleges and was part of as much of it as I could be, you know, whilst not wearing the uniform. And it seemed to me that everyone was having an enormous amount of fun that perhaps I ought to be part of. So halfway through my university time, I did 4 years at Loughborough studying a Master of Engineering degree, and I've been a member of the Officer Training Corps, so the Territorial Army, whilst for a couple of years whilst I was there. And again, that was a really good grounding for what was about to come. But I did my Admiralty Interview Board and picked up a Navy bursary for my last couple of years at university, and then joined immediately on completion of my examinations.
Right, so Cook was a guy who pushed back the boundaries of human knowledge and exploration. So with a scientific inclination, engineering inclination like you do have, is would you say that right from the beginning you were looking in the Navy for things that would take you to the cutting edge?
Yes, I suppose so, although probably not consciously. I think there are three things about Cook which I find hugely impressive and inspirational, and I try and emulate in how I do my own business. So the first is that he had a real intellectual curiosity. He wanted to find out about stuff. You know, he learned surveying from an army surveyor whose name escapes me in Canada, and you know, he saw him doing it. He said, "Hey, how does this work?" And he got involved and he learned to do it. And that leads on to the second thing, which he had this absolute culture of professional excellence. So he set standards for himself, importantly, and those that he led, to be excellent and make excellence his habit in all that he did. And I used that when I led either my own departments or the Navy acquisition team. I used to say to them, excellence is a habit. It comes from an Aristotle quote. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence is therefore not an act, but a habit. And if we make excellence our habit in all that we do, whether that's engineering, our personal conduct, military bearing, you know, so on and so on and so on, then we'll be a little bit better tomorrow than we were today and a little bit better today than we were yesterday, and we can keep moving forward. And Cook was all about that. And he combined that with a really tough but compassionate care for his people. It was typical in those days, on a long sea passage, the sort of thing he was doing, taking the ships to the Pacific for the whole transit of Venus and so on, to lose about a third of one ship's company to disease and scurvy, particularly, and other things. He lost nobody, zero, partly because his meticulous application of cleanliness, also enforcing a diet which included some vitamin C, which kept the scurvy at bay. He had one guy fall sick ashore in Australia, but at sea they lost nobody until they got to the East Indies, where they all picked up, I don't know, dysentery or diphtheria or something, or typhus, and it ravaged the ship's company. But that was beyond his control. And he was ruthless and relentless about insisting on the very highest of standards for the benefit of his ship's company. And I was always really impressed with that. And they followed him, not because he was a tyrant, but because they loved him and trusted him.
Right. So what was your first experience of the sea? I mean, where did you get your introduction to life on the ocean wave and, really get out there like Cook had done,
Yeah. I mean, probably cross-channel ferries going on camping holidays to northern France. And, you know, I was always super excited going in and out of Portsmouth to see the warships there. And I used to say to my dad, oh, do you think I'll ever get to go on one of those? I'd love to go and have a look round the aircraft carrier. And he said, oh, I don't think they do that sort of thing, son. You know. But so I was never really, we were never really sailors. I grew up in Watford, so quite a long way from the sea. I mean, I enjoyed dinghy sailing in Rickmansworth Aquadrome and this sort of thing. But it wasn't really until I joined the Navy that I got to go to sea properly and absolutely loved it. I'll tell you a little anecdote, Ian. My mum and dad came on for a family's day, and you'll know that ships do this from time to time, where they take a day, they bring all the families in, people can, invite broadly who they want, and you get a look around the ship. The ship typically will go to sea for the day, and there'll be some demonstrations, and everyone will have lunch, and helicopters will come to fly past or whatever, just to give families a feel for where their loved ones, their sailors and marines, go and serve. And these are great fun days. And my mum and dad had done something like that with the Navy. And they were just about to get off the gangway. And my mum, I mean, both my parents, always super supportive, my biggest cheerleaders, but she never really quite understood why I wanted to be in the Navy. What was it that was driving me? Why do I have this vocation? And just as they were sort of getting off, she just sort of paused and looked at me and looked around the ship. And she said to me, son, you're a round peg in a round hole here, aren't you? This is where you belong. And I said, it is, Mum. It is. This is me. This is where I belong. And she went, I get it. I get it, son. And off she went.
Yeah.
And it was great. And I always at sea felt like a round peg in a round hole. I absolutely loved it. And when my seagoing career came to an end, when I left HMS Queen Elizabeth and I went into Navy, what we were then calling ships acquisition, but the portfolio broadened through Navy transformation, I had to have a real think about why I was still in the Navy. What was it that was going to get me out of bed every day? Because it wasn't about the next sea job and building for that. It was, it had to be about something else. And so I made it my mission. And the mission of the teams that I was leading, that I had always, being at sea, had always had ships, equipment, support services, the logistics, the training, and everything else, that someone else had done the groundwork, the legwork, so that when we went out to do the job we were tasked to do, it was there for us. And I realized that that was now my job, that I had a custodianship for our sailors of today and especially tomorrow, to make sure that they had the equipment they needed, the ships that they needed, the training that was available, the infrastructure, and all of those other things, all those other components of the capability, so that they had what they needed to go and do their job on behalf of our nation. And once I'd worked out that that was what was going to drive me, you know, right, that's it, game on, let's go. And I was fully committed to that until it was time for me to move on to other things.
So you joined the Navy front line, as it were, in the late 90s. Would that be correct? Is that when you?
Well, so I started at Dartmouth in June 99. So at the very end of the 90s, if you like, and went off to France, as you mentioned in your introduction, to do an exchange pretty promptly.
And what was that? All about. Why did they, had you been a naughty boy or something? Why did they send you off to join the French Navy? What was that?
Well, so every now and then, and it still happens, you get this sort of rapprochement between ministers of the two nations and indeed, you know, other European partners and so on and allies. And there'd been this meeting between UK ministers and French ministers about how we're going to have closer defence cooperation. And one of the things they'd agreed on was an exchange of officer training. So this sort of cascaded down to the Commodore at Dartmouth. And he said, oh, okay, right. He passed that on to his team. By the way, one of the lieutenant commander who was running the universities and ERNU office then was a guy called Tony Radakin.
Oh, yeah.
He was a lieutenant commander back in those days. I mean, no, I don't think anyone's quite sure what happened to him subsequently, but...
No idea.
he was there. There was a guy working with him called Dave Goldsmith, who was the university's officer. So he was looking after me as a bursar. Anyway, he was sort of given the problem to find people who were going to join the Navy in that year that they could send to France. And what they said was, look, there's no point sending you to France for 6 months and then making you do Dartmouth for 6 months or vice versa. Because it's just going to, you know, what's the point? So we need to try and find someone that we can send to France who we're confident we can take the risk on that they won't do new entry training or the initial sea training term at Dartmouth. And because of my experience at Manadern and because of my experience in the officer training corps, I was considered sufficiently militarized, and that I got it enough that they could take that risk. So I didn't have a new entry division that I joined with. I turned up on my own. I drove down in my little Nissan Micra and not knowing any better, I drove in Dartmouth, you know, got my car pass at the gate. And then I drove up round the ramps at Dartmouth.
Oh, really?
Parked outside the front door, went into the hall porter and said, hi, I'm Steve. I'm here to join the Navy. And of course, for those that know, this is a little bit, and he went, right, first thing, don't park there ever again. And you're not allowed to come in that door till you've passed out and finished your training. I'm like, oh, right, sorry. Anyway, now we got that out of the way. And so I did spend the summer doing a load of language training because this was a thing. Dave Goldsmith, the university's officer, phoned me up and he said, look, we're setting this thing up, Steve. We think we want to send you. And we've got a plan to find a second person. But what do you think about it? I said, oh, sounds great. So the only snag is I don't speak much French. Well, don't worry. You'll pick that up while you're out there. and I did, but... Those first few months were quite challenging, but the French were great. Actually, I mean, my classmates were brilliant in looking after me, and it was an exercise for me in just shutting up and doing what I was told. So one of the big things they teach you at Dartmouth is how to lead, how to take charge, how to stand up and give a, you know. Well, I never really had a problem doing that. Perhaps I was a bit too keen to do that even, but because I didn't speak the language very well, and therefore I didn't really have necessarily a full understanding. I just had to sometimes shut up and do what I was told. And that lesson in humility was probably a more important lesson for me at that time in my life. I mean, there'll be some who argue that I should have learnt it longer and harder in that, but than actually trying to tell me to be more confident, because that wasn't the problem I suffered with at that time. So anyway, that was that. And it gave me the opportunity to spend 6 months in France, by which time I was pretty fluent in French. I came back, passed out of Dartmouth, did my young officer's fleet time in HMS Iron Duke. And then I went back to France in their, they had a sort of, what we would have known as in the old money as the Dartmouth training squadron. So their helicopter carrier, the Jeanne d'Arc, and the escort frigate, the Georges Legge, was going off around the world for 6 months with that year's batch of young officers. And I was given the opportunity to go back and basically do 6 months of their fleet time with them, cruising off around the world. So that was great. And by the time I'd done that, you know, my first 18 months in the Navy, having spent a year with the French, including at sea, doing bridge work and upstream and engineering stuff and all the other things, my French was pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, the current edition, to get in a bit of a plug for the mag, the new edition of the mag has the visit of the French training squadron to Halifax in Nova Scotia in it, which is one of their LHDs, their amphibious ships, and also a frigate. And we obviously also report on the Japanese sending their training ships off, which they've just deployed, actually. We've had that in the magazine, sending their officer cadets off similarly on several months at sea. And it's not something that I think the Royal Navy does anymore. In my time covering the Royal Navy from the early 90s, there was I went to Sevastopol once in the Crimea, and HMS Fearless or Intrepid, I can't remember which one now, she was being used as the Dartmouth training ship. So just digressing slightly, having experienced all that you had as an intro with the French, albeit with the French, do you think that's something that the Royal Navy kind of lacks these days or needs to get back into, is some kind of training cruise for officer cadet?
Well, so I think broadening that point out, and I do think it's a really important point. So the Navy, as you know, has a scarcity of ships to put to sea at the moment, and for that matter, submarines, which I think is a entirely related but slightly separate challenge. And one of the consequences of that is that we can't get trainees to sea, whether officers or ratings, in the same sorts of volumes and for the same sort of times that we used to. Now, there are lots of innovative and clever things that have been done in terms of trying to compress the time, you know, competence-based experience, get through your task books in a much more structured way. But there is something about the maritime environment, any technical, professional, complex environment where you just have to spend time immersed in it to really understand the expertise. The best commanding officers that I served under, and I didn't spend anywhere near as much time at sea as some of my warfare officer seamen colleagues, but just had this innate, you know, you'd be, it's sort of a slightly apocryphal tale, but you'd be sat in the captain's cabin, say, having a briefing them on something, and all of a sudden they'd just sort of go, wait a moment, Steve, and their spidey sense would have gone off, and then they'd just scuttle up the ladder to the bridge, you know, or whatever, and then come and go, right, that's all sorted. What happened there? They go, oh, you know, I could just tell from, you know, the sound of, they'd have picked up the strain of some, and they might not have even known themselves why, but they just got that inkling that something wasn't quite right, and they needed to go. And you only get that level of intuitive understanding of the environment by spending time in it and spending time in the role and knowing what good looks like. And one of the concerns I've got about our current Navy, because of the lack of ships and therefore the lack of opportunities to get people to sea, and we've had quite a good, quite a big pull through of people. So a lot of people going out the top, and we've turned up the recruiting taps a bit, and there's been some really good work, genuinely good work done in terms of how we recruit people quicker and faster and in greater volumes. But unless you can resource that training pipeline so that everyone has the right experience and enough experience for their rate, you know, you're sort of running with quite inexperienced people. And I'm chatting to some friends who've been at sea recently, and in some cases are at sea. You know, they recognize that the experience that we used to rely on, for example, at the senior ratings level, at petty officers and chiefs, a lot of those people and leading hands, a lot of those people now don't have the experience that they perhaps would have had before. You know, their number of sea days is in the hundreds rather than the thousands, for example. And the junior officers likewise. And so that the sort of floor of experience that you're relying on to know what good looks like and drive standards and do all the things that Captain Cook did, it starts to get higher and higher and higher. And my concern is, as that works its way through the system, who is the guardian of standards? Who does know what good looks like? Who has got more experience? Because, of course, you can tick the task books and, you know, you go through and, yes, I've done a set of breakdown drills or I've done, and that's fine, and you have to be able to do that. But we all know that, you know, doing your driving lessons, passing your driving test, you still have to become a better driver than that. You know, that's the sort of minimum, but you're not really equipped to deal with everything you might encounter, and your experience will grow very steeply over those next few months of actually driving and finding your way around new cities or so we need to think hard about that, about when we turn on the recruiting taps, what does that mean for our training pipeline? And I think with lean crewed, where we're looking at hybrid forces or lean crewed or whatever, there's a danger that you don't have the opportunities for people to do their, you know, in inverted commas, journeyman's time. You know, they don't get to go and be the tool bag carrier, but because we've thinned down to a level. So you have to hit the ground running with all of the skills and all of the competencies. And those career opportunities to build that experience in the environment become a different thing. And we need to put, in my view, deliberate thought into how we address that. And I know people are.
Yeah. I mean, we will come back to that when we get to the hybrid Navy part of it, definitely, because that was going through my head as well. But just having a bit of more of a look at your career, your very impressive career. Am I right in thinking when you were in HMS Westminster, would that, you said, was that the one that you were aboard off Libya? And would that be during the war itself?
Yeah, so fascinating time. We were actually alongside in London as the duty towed array patrol ship. So we'd been worked up, we'd been through operational sea training, and were kitted up, most importantly, and I'll come back to that in a moment. We were kitted up to do the North Atlantic, chase Russian submarines around. So this was 2011, first half of 2011. And we were alongside in London, and it was actually, we were having the reception for the local dignitaries and, you know, capability demonstration, blah, blah, but, you know, hosting the sort of formal reception. And the captain got a phone call, you know, it's all kicking off in Libya. The ship had noticed to go. Whoever was badged as the fleet ready escort, and I can't remember who it was or why, but they weren't considered, you know, appropriate for the task. So we were sort of basically told, don't pass go, don't collect £200, you know, straight round. Anyway, of course it, you know, took us a little while, to a couple of days just to get ourselves sorted out to do that. And off we went. And so we went straight past Portsmouth, straight down channel, called in at Gibraltar. We did a store ship overnight. And then straight round into the Med. Obviously, we replenished on the way through. And then we sat off the Libyan coast, you know, 13 miles off, basically doing intelligence gathering and ISR type activities and reporting back. And it was fascinating because we could see. If you think of the North African coast, you've got the Bay of Sirte. And you sort of Tripoli over one side, Benghazi over the other, which is where a lot of the center of the rebel activity. And so somewhere in the middle, down the south, I'm doing this from memory, so, you know, was a place called Sirte, S-I-R-T-E. And there was an airfield there, which was in the hands of the Gaddafi forces. And we could see on our radar the airplanes taxiing at Sirte, taking off at the runway, doing this racetrack over Benghazi, dropping their ordnance and then returning to base. And one day one of the aircraft took off that way, went over Sirte, and then came straight out into the bay, overflew, as I recall, a Turkish ship, and then came on a trajectory close enough to us that we, you know, caused a bit of alarm. So air threat warning red, you know, hands to action stations, and we've been at defense watches, so, you know, on we go. And it was pretty tense, and they sort of turned away, responded to warnings and turned away, but it was pretty tense. You know, I seem to recall the petty officer, who was the missile director, was requesting permission to lock them up with the fire control radar, and, you know, the captain and the warfare team, you know, did a really good job of keeping the, you know, no, not yet, because we had, I think, de-escalatory rules of engagement and so on and so on. But nonetheless, you know, quite an exciting time. But that was all going on. And then when the UN resolution was passed, we were there for the first couple of days of the strikes. And then as I think HMS Liverpool, and Colin Williams was in Liverpool.
Yeah, the Type 42, yeah.
Yeah, started to come in, and Ocean was inbound, and there was a bunch of Americans. So we saw, you know, at night, I remember one of my engineering technicians who was doing rounds and had gone up into the radar mast. So you have to go up across the bridge reef on a 23 into the radar mast. And he sort of stood jaw agape as these Tomahawk land attack missiles were streaking across the sky from an American ship in their firing box, you know, a couple of miles away or whatever. And he thought that was, you know, just wow. So, but then we were hauled off. I mean, we only had, and this was the thing, we only had, and it was reported in the press at the time, so I'm not telling tales out of school, but we only had 4 Seawolf missiles on board at the time and no Harpoon. We'd taken on some extra gun ammunition in Gibraltar and had to vert rep some countermeasures because, as I say, we were kitted out and stored for the North Atlantic mission. But it was a real lesson for me in, you know, one of the major attributes of sea power is its flexibility. You can retask ships to do different things. And so the importance of being ready for whatever might come, if you're, you know, one of the few frontline, you know, high readiness units. So yeah, you might think you're going to do one thing, but it's really quite straightforward to be flipped across to do something else. And, you know, it was pretty hairy. Now we did have some missiles, and had that jet or something else happened, and we'd had to engage, then we would have been making really big steps, back up to, towards Malta, after that. But you know, there's a lesson for me there in, well, just in time is probably not in time if your job is to be the responder of last resort in time of crisis for the nation, which is really the role of the armed forces in many ways. So you need to be ready to go. And so I'm really pleased with the defense investment plan and the focus on renewing stockpiles and focus on that logistics chain, the logistics component of readiness, which I think has been underinvested in and underappreciated for the last few decades.
I mean, it just struck me, because we did quite a bit on the old Libya thing, and in one of our guides to the Royal Navy, we interviewed, I think, 6 or 7 commanding officers of ships, and we got a great array of Q&As there. And of course, they did naval gunfire support. And Colin Williams, CO of Liverpool, I interviewed him separately, I think, in the mag itself. They did an aircraft direction role, and they were very close in. So in my mind, it was the last, I mean, I may be wrong here, it was the last commitment at scale under fire for the Royal Navy, I think. And I don't think there's been one like that since, has there, really?
Well, I think it depends what you mean by at scale. But, I mean, certainly the Red Sea was getting pretty spicy, with HMS Diamond. You know, I mean, they had some pretty spicy engagements out there, I think, recently with the Houthis and the drones and some anti-ship missiles of various types. So I think so. But it did get, you know, it got quite interesting. I was, when I left Westminster, the next summer, 2012, I went to staff course, the Advanced Commander Staff Course at Shrivenham, and Colin Williams was on the course with me. He was the senior, I think he was a senior student, maybe the senior naval student. Anyway, but so I got to know Colin a little bit. Great guy.
Yeah, I mean, I had a little bit of contact with him recently because he's the defense attaché in Tokyo. So that was he was helping organize the visit of Prince of Wales there. So he's still in the Navy as far as I'm aware. But coming back to your role though, and talking of carriers, the sister vessel of HMS Prince of Wales, Queen Elizabeth. I mean, being the commander, weapon engineer aboard the first of the new big carriers, the flagship of the Royal Navy, that must have been a heck of a responsibility. So how did you feel when you got the appointment there? Awestruck, or were you in your traditional confidence, ready to go and, you know, quite sure that you'd managed to tackle it all?
Yeah, no, I was really excited. I mean, it was one of those things that had been on the front page of my, well, we call them an OJAR, the Officer's Joint Appraisal Report. So your annual report. And on the front page, you get to put your aspirations and, you know, what jobs you'd like and why, and your own comments. And being Commander Weapon Engineer in one of the Queen Elizabeth class carriers had been on the front page of my OJAR since like forever. So actually to get to go and do it was a real fillip for me. I was very excited. Of course, the time we were there, I went up there in January 2016. And I was supposed to be up there for about 6 months before we took the ship to sea and brought it down to Portsmouth and brought it into service and so on. In the end, I was there for 18 months before that happened. But in that time, we were effectively on loan as a ship's company to the Aircraft Carrier Alliance, which was MOD, BAE, Babcock, Thales, and then there was a propulsion sub-alliance, which included GE and some others. And we were all work. So we were working as a team up there because we were effectively the trials crew to take the ship to sea for the first time and put it through the contractor sea trials before it was handed over to the MOD. So we had this relationship for the most part very constructive with our industrial partners who had the responsibility for building, setting to work, commissioning the kit, getting through the test forms. And my team, my maintainers, same for my counterpart and the marine marine engineer and so on, were providing people to support those efforts and help them out whilst getting our own teams built up, getting all the things you need in place to set up a new ship and a new department, and training ourselves so that we were competent in that ship with those systems to take it to sea and operate it safely for those first sort of baby steps of her operational or seagoing life. So that was a job, really. And of course, also no one in the Navy only has one job, Ian. So I also was the head of media and public relations for the ship. So I had a very close working relationship with the Aircraft Carrier Alliance media and comms lead. And we were, because of course it was a topic of great interest. I'm sure you would have been up there and we used to host media days and parliamentarians and other distinguished visitors and so on and so on, and try and manage the, correspondence with media inquiries and all of this sort of thing. So there was quite a job to do on that side of the house as well. But I thoroughly enjoyed that aspect of the job.
This podcast is for people who are informed, know quite a lot, ex-RM people in the defence industry, if they want to tune in or rather download. But also, of course, there'll be other general listeners. So what does the Commander Weapon Engineer do? What is that person responsible for, and how does it integrate with the people that have been there, presumably for quite a bit longer, during the actual build? I mean, how does, because you said you joined, 6 months before she was due to go to sea. So what is in simple terms, what's the job of the Commander Weapon Engineer and also his team or her team?
Yeah, so I took over from someone who'd been there earlier on. So some of the first people in to the ship's company were the heads of department and some key non-commissioned officers, warrant officers and the like, to sort of get those structures going and start working with the Aircraft Carrier Alliance. But what is the job? Well, you're head of the Weapon Engineering Department. Now you have a lieutenant commander who's doing their charge job, who works for you, who sort of acts as the WEO, if you like, on a day-to-day basis. In my day, they were called the senior weapon engineer. These days, I think they're actually called the WEO, which I think is positive. And the thing about an aircraft carrier or their sort of capital ship is there's a whole load of stuff to do, which is focused on what the ship provides in a slightly more strategic way to the tactical day-to-day. So whilst, yes, you do have responsibility for leading and managing your own department, of course, it's more about how you work with the rest of the command team to make sure you're facilitating, for example, a carrier strike group that come on board. So this embarked battle staff. And they don't come with their own weapon engineer. So you effectively become their advisor for weapon engineering type issues. And a mate of mine was the commander weapon engineer in HMS Prince of Wales. In fact, he was a lieutenant who worked for me in Queen Elizabeth and then was Commander Weapon Engineering Prince of Wales when they've just done the recent HIMARS deployment. So it's fascinating to see how he got on. He's absolutely brilliant. I mean, better at the job than I ever was. But he was also the group commander WE, if you like. So when they needed to do examinations for lieutenants going for their charge qualification, he would go across to those ships and do those sort of exams and do assurance visits. And So you're acting really at the battle staff level, and thinking about those up and out relationships as much as you are the sort of in and down. And of course, it's just a much bigger organization to run. So it's a bit like, I mean, when I was in Afghanistan, and I wasn't there for that long, and I didn't do anything very brave, but I was in the task force Helmand headquarters. And so you've got the task force there, and then, you know, in one corner you'd have the Royal Engineers, and you'd have the CEO of the Engineers, and they'd be responsible for all the things that the Engineers do, you know, out around the different battle groups that made up that brigade. Same for the artillery. You know, the CEO of the artillery was also SO1 I star in the headquarters. And it was a bit like that, where you're you're a commander weapon engineer, but you're part of that headquarters team, and making sure you join up with all those other functional leaders in the team to make sure we service the command and the mission. So that's really the nub of the job.
In simple terms, I've had it explained to me during various warship visits, but I think for our people listening to this who may not know, the weapons engineer department, or we own and their team and yourself aboard Queen Elizabeth as well. That's a responsibility for delivering the ordnance to the users, as it were, and also looking after the functioning of sensors and just the machinery of any weaponry on board. Was that a simple way of describing it?
Yes. So the way I always explain it to people, Ian, is there are three kinds of engineers in the Navy. I mean, we'll leave the submariners to one side for a moment, but three kinds of engineers in a warship. You've got the air engineers who look after, you know, the aeroplanes, helicopters, and when they're embarked on the aviation facility stuff. You've got the marine engineers who look after everything that makes the ship a ship, and then you've got the weapon engineers who look after everything that makes it a warship. So, yes, guns, yes, ammunition, yes, torpedoes, but also all the sensors, navigation systems, command and control, data networks, and the computers and communications type stuff. So everything that goes buzz, bang, beep, ping, or whoosh, or at least is supposed to. Now, when you come to the carriers, it's slightly different, because it's actually the air engineer officer who's the explosives responsible officer, because most of the ordnance carried by net explosive quantity are air weapons, you know, bombs and missiles for the air group. So it was actually the commander air engineer who was the explosives responsible officer. But we as weapon engineers were responsible for the magazines and the magazine systems. They actually had custody, if you like, or responsibility for looking after the explosives. But I mean, the other thing about it is, as the technology I used to tease my marine engineer colleagues, because I say, listen, I've got all these different sections with this great variety of different types of technology and different types of equipment. I said, you've only got two types of equipment. And they'd look at me and I say, you know, one, electricity goes in and it goes round. The other, it goes round and electricity comes out. That's pretty much it, right? Of course, I was being mischievous. But in Queen Elizabeth, the Commander ME was very keen to remind me that his gear, in terms of the whole platform management system and the complex firefighting, his kit had actually more lines of code in it than mine did. And I suppose the takeaway from that is, in the way that technology is going in the navies, is actually to bring this convergence of technology in terms of marine and weapon engineering in particular, but I think also to a certain extent in air engineering. When we start thinking about drones, I'm sure that's true. And so you have to be much more savvy about how you're bringing these things together as systems of systems to deliver actual capability. And of course, as has always been the case in warships and always will be in terms of delivering effect in and from the sea, you've got to work as a team. And whilst we might tease each other a bit, actually those relationships that are based on having each other's back, based on trust, based on cooperation, based on, you know, being generous with whatever support you can offer, and also being prepared to take challenge when you don't get it quite right, you know, are absolutely key. And we had a really good team. I mean, I've been really fortunate that every ship I've served in has been a brilliant ship to serve in. And the officers have been great, and the senior rates have been terrific. And that's not to say it's not without its tensions and challenges. But of course, the test of a team is how you work through the difficulties. You know, how you work through. I used to describe it, particularly actually with my colleagues in Abbey Wood when I was in Navy Acquisition. I used to say, look, we know if we've got the culture of this program right, because we can have conversations about difficult things without them becoming difficult conversations. And that's the kind of culture you've got to be able to have. But you've got to have trust, and you've got to have openness, and you've got to have a willingness to be challenged, in the jargon, the psychological safety in the team, to make sure everyone's doing the right thing, not just the easy thing. And again, there's something about the hybrid Navy in that context that we might pick up on.
Thanks for listening to part one of our discussion with Steve Prest. Put under the spotlight in part two are plans for a hybrid Navy, which is apparently to be crewed where necessary, uncrewed where possible, integrated always, as the Royal Navy describes it. I think it's well worth a listen by all UK defence decision makers, including those in government and the Royal Navy. For more food for thought from the Warships IFR magazine menu, please do check out the September 2026 edition, which comes out on the 21st of August. On the menu is a Submarine in Focus series of articles, a look at Spain's Atlantic leadership in NATO, an exercise Unitas preview. Other tasty items include a photo essay on President Putin's luxury rescue vessel, which is an unusual ship that has been assigned to Moscow's Northern Fleet, and also whether or not the Iran and Ukraine wars are merging. And if all that isn't enough to keep you satisfied and nice and full with all your naval news, analysis and commentary, there's also something on how the US Navy needs more bangs for bucks. Plenty to get your teeth into, and available in shops, direct from the publisher as a hard copy edition, and digitally. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at WarshipsIFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at WarshipsIFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.